minus the sixth, the conductor Vladimir Fedoseyev, and that should please the many people who have asked to hear Glazunov's symphonies. So please do join me same time next Sunday morning at 9 o'clock.
Sunday Morning with Rob Cowan is a unique production for BBC Radio 3 with studio production this morning by Lyndon Jones.
The BBC National Orchestra of Wales is live in concert. Thomas Zondergaard conducts one of Haydn's London Symphonies, number 99. And in the second half, soprano Gisela Stiller and baritone John Lundgren join the BBC National Orchestra and Chorus of Wales for Brahms's choral masterpiece, his German Requiem. Live in concert with Haydn and Brahms, Friday evening at 7:30 here on BBC Radio 3, or listen in HD sound via the Radio 3 website.
And now it's time for Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is the musician Nitin Sawhney.
Nitin Sawhney is a multi-award-winning musician, producer and composer. With 9 studio albums to his credit, he's collaborated with the likes of Paul McCartney, Joss Stone, Sting, Akram Khan and Nelson Mandela, and has composed over 40 film and television scores, including for the BBC series Human Planet. It's a career which has taken him all over the world, but he's rooted here in southwest London, and anyone lucky enough to live near him can probably enjoy hearing a rather unusual kind of dawn chorus. I think that's because, Nitin, you get up early to practice, don't you? Piano and guitar.
Yeah, I do that. I still do that quite a lot. Yeah, I mean, I also do a lot of physical exercise and yoga and training whenever I can, whenever I feel fit enough, actually. But yeah, I think it's always important to start with some practice. So I kind of like to make my morning quite a lot about discipline.
I wonder whether you feel, Nitin, as some people do, I certainly do, that there's a time of day which is particularly productive for you.
Yeah, actually, I really like 4 o'clock in the morning for some bizarre reason, which is probably quite irritating for anyone who happens to be in the vicinity at the time. But I particularly like that time of day because I feel it's, or time of night rather, because it feels like I can express whatever is going on in my dreams or in that kind of twilight world that between dream and reality. And I remember Einstein actually used to, not that I'm comparing myself to him, but I remember that Einstein used to have this bucket of water apparently by his hand so that when he would drop off to sleep, his hand would fall in that bucket of water and he'd wake himself up with a new idea or a fresh thought. And I think that sums up that kind of feeling of being kind of half asleep and also able to write down your thoughts from the subconscious or from the unconscious world is a really great way to kind of get down ideas and to get inspiration.
Of course, the important thing is to write them down before you forget them.
Yeah, I think that's very important. But I think that's the thing is for me, I always had instruments around me. And there was one place that I lived in, I guess, in the 90s, a place where I'd have my whole studio around me in my bedroom. And I'd quite often just dip into various ideas through playing on the keyboards or playing something from a computer even.
But now, in order to improve your sleep, you commute to work.
Yeah, I keep my studio very separately. It's based in Brixton. I'm a bit obsessive about what I do, so I have to kind of rein myself in. I think actually having the idea of a working day really kind of helps to attenuate those feelings, I guess.
One of the pieces that you think is a good workout for early in the morning is your first choice, isn't it?
Yeah, I love playing Chopin. I used to love playing Chopin as a kid as well. It's really challenging for your fingers and for your mood as well. I mean, particularly this piece, Fantasy Impromptu. If you're playing through this piece, you have to switch your mood very quickly after the initial fireworks and intricacy of the fingerwork. And I think it's quite bizarre because the idea of focusing on your thumb a lot when you're playing a piece of music and putting your attention on that, sometimes you have to do that with this piece. It's very difficult to get the fingering right unless you have a subconscious awareness of that. So I'm always trying to get that right.
Well, let's hear it now. I don't think we're going to have you on this occasion. Who would you choose for this breakfast appointment?
Well, I particularly like the performance from Murray Pariah.
Thank you.
Beautiful.
You were talking about the some of the problems of playing that piece, the change of mood, for example, and then the position of the thumb. It's interesting you mentioned the thumb, because Murray Pariah, who we heard there playing the Fantasy Impromptu by Chopin, actually, about 10 years ago, injured that thumb.
Wow, that would be a problem. I had a thumb injury myself, actually, about a year ago, which caused me a lot of problems. But I can imagine if he's playing that piece in concert a lot, I can imagine it would be a real problem.
You grew up in Kent, Nitin Sawhney, where you and your two brothers were, I think, the only Asians at your secondary school. Given that this was the 60s and early 70s, probably not a terribly easy time.
It was an odd time. At one point, I think the National Front were getting at one point more votes than the Liberal Party, and there'd be regular marches through the streets of Chatham and so on. It was difficult in that at school, I think that reflected, and there were, you know, I had some negative experiences. But it was also quite inspiring in a weird way, because I'd go into my room and I'd always feel like playing music. That was my refuge, you know, just going into my bedroom with the piano or the guitar and just playing through pieces that I loved, or just improvising or trying to express things I was feeling. In some ways, that was kind of because of the context I was in.
It was quite a musical household, wasn't it?
To some degree. I think certainly my mum and dad loved listening to a lot of diverse music. I mean, my dad had music from Cuba and, of course, a lot of Indian classical music, but also a lot of flamenco in the house, which was wonderful. And actually, there was a picture of my dad passed away last year, sadly, but there was a picture of him that we grew up with where he was sitting there playing a sitar. So I always had this impression until I was about 11 that he'd been this great sitar player, and then one day he broke it to me that he'd actually just posed for the photograph and had no idea how to play it. But my mum was a Bharatanatyam dancer, which is an Indian classical form of dance, and so she had also got a very strong sense of rhythm and melody. You know, there was always music in the house.
You studied law and accountancy for a while, but I think there's a very touching story after the death of your father. You're finding a letter from him, which kind of, I'm not saying you wouldn't have been liberated anyway, but it perhaps triggered something.
Yeah. Shortly after my dad passed away, with my mum, I was going through all of his paperwork, and literally it was the first thing that I opened up. A letter just fell out, and it was addressed to me. And he'd written it quite a long time before, and it was about when I'd quit accountancy. It was beautiful because he was saying he really was very happy for me, and that because I think at the time it was very difficult for, as it is, would be for most Asian parents, to accept their son moving away from a very solid career in accountancy or law or anything like that to becoming a musician. And he was obviously very worried at the time, but ultimately in this letter he was giving me a seal of approval, which was amazing. And to find that as the first thing shortly after he'd passed away was almost an epiphany.
And I think one of the CDs which you found at home, which you knew, in fact, was a recording of flamenco guitar.
Yeah.
And that was to be quite an influence too.
Huge, huge. I mean, my dad stunned me with two albums that I heard. One was from Pandit G. Ravi Shankar when I was about 7, but also when I was 8 or 9, I heard this album from a guy called Philip John Lee, who I believe was from Norwich, but who'd played with people like Paco Peña and had a fantastic ability as a flamenco guitarist. And I remember years later, after hearing this, going to have some lessons with him in West Kensington. And he was a really lovely guy, and he passed away a couple of years back. But his brother wrote to me and said that he'd enjoyed teaching me, which was really nice.
So what are we going to hear?
Well, we're going to hear probably my greatest hero of the guitar, let alone flamenco guitar, which is Paco de Lucía. And his technique was second to none. I mean, this is him playing solo guitar, and it's a very beautiful piece, and it's a piece I'm actually currently trying to learn myself. So it's Guajiras de Lucía. Thank you.
So amazing, the articulation there. You almost feel as though it must have been speeded up.
That's the thing, even watching him live, you felt that there was some kind of camera trick going on. The precision and the grace with which he plays that was always just jaw-dropping, really.
Guajiras de Lucia, composed and performed by Paco de Lucia. One of your biggest challenges, Nitin Sawhney, must have been working on the music for the BBC series Human Planet. Just tell us a bit about the aspects of that series that were particularly challenging for you.
I think it was very difficult to write the music for a series that, you know, I literally had 8 weeks to write all the music. Each episode needed 50 minutes of music. That meant I had literally 1 week to write the equivalent of an orchestral album. What I loved about the series was it was really a celebration of human resilience. It was about looking at humans in different types of environment. It was incredibly inspiring to work to as a musician because you're looking at stunning images. For example, people who saw the series may remember the underwater diver who would actually be able to hold his breath for up to 5 minutes, where he'd be walking on the seabed, harpooning various creatures, you know, and be functioning almost as a person would be walking down the road to the shop. But ultimately, you are writing every note and thinking also about how all of that is going to marry up to the image. It's a complex process.
The next music conjures up pictures, doesn't it? It's Debussy, and has often been described as one of the signposts to 20th century music, and does somehow evoke a world, doesn't it, through the use of colour and harmony. And it's utterly beguiling.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I always say that I feel like almost instantly I've got this image of sunlight coming through trees in a forest. You know, as soon as you hear those opening notes, in a way it feels more than music. Like there's an atmosphere, mood of feeling and images that are just jumping off the page constantly. So
jumping is a rather good given what it's about. And maybe we won't say what it's about till the end, because although it's a very famous piece, so lots of people will know the title, for those that don't, it might be interesting to see what it does conjure up. Well, I wonder what mental images that conjured up for people. But of course, many will know that it was Debussy's prelude à l'après-midi d'un faune, prelude to the afternoon of a faun. André Previn conducting the London Symphony Orchestra. I suppose the other thing which we didn't mention, Nitin Sawhney, is the way that right from the outset, that flute, solo flute, kind of crosses the bar line. So he deliberately says, you don't need to worry about where the beat is here. Yeah. And, of course, that's interesting that it was André Previn conducting the London Symphony Orchestra, a musician who knew quintessentially in his soul how to, as they say, play lazy.
Well, it's interesting because I guess it's called rubato in Western classical music, but in Indian classical music you have the concept of the alap, which precedes the idea of introducing tempos. And I think it's really wonderful with Debussy, with this particular piece, how it's just fluid. It's like water. And in the same way that I listen to an alap from Panditji Ravi Shankar or Hariprasad Chaurasia, those guys can really evoke so much without even thinking about tempo at all.
Actually, it's nice that you've come on to Ravi Shankar, because your 10th album is out shortly and there's a performance in the Royal Albert Hall in September. You've called it Dystopian Dream, a rather disturbing title, but then I think each of your albums has been a kind of emotional chapter for you, hasn't it, which reflects things that have happened. And you've been very preoccupied with loss, the sense of loss, the loss of your father, the loss of Ravi Shankar.
Yeah, I think this album particularly focuses on that. But it's also, as you say, with each album, I almost use them as therapy. They have to start as catharsis. And then it's about how much I'm willing to share with the outside world as well. But with Dystopian Dream, it's a sense of trying to connect with those feelings that I have about my father and that I had about Ravi Shankar when he died. I guess it's kind of a perspective that I'm trying to articulate through music.
You collaborated with Ravi Shankar's daughter, Anushka, and your godfather, I think, to her child. And you spent some time at Ravi Shankar's deathbed, didn't you? Which must have been very extraordinary as he slipped away into another world.
Well, I felt very privileged to be asked to attend his bedside. But I remember there was a moment when I was holding his arm, and I remember my father, when I was very young, playing me a Ravi Shankar album. And I remember turning around to my dad and saying, how is he doing that? I mean, is there some kind of trick involved? And my dad said, what do you mean? I said, well, how can anyone play that fast? I mean, I presume they've sped it up or something. And he said, no, that's Ravi Shankar. That's how he plays, which I couldn't believe. And then I spent ages trying to reproduce what he was doing on a guitar. And then I remember, you know, when I was holding his arm at that last moment, just thinking that's the arm, you know, that inspired me all those years ago when I was 7, and thinking that's the arm that played that incredibly, you know, that was that virtuoso arm that inspired me to want to be a musician in so many ways.
So rather wonderful that the piece we're going to hear is a very joyous one, all about the Spring Festival of Colours.
Absolutely. And it comes from the rag Kafi, which is actually the name of the tart, which means the family of rags. A rag is like a scale. It's more than a scale, and it's actually differs ascending and descending, like say a melodic minor does. The main thing is that they conjure up a particular time of day or a season, so they're associated with moods and colours. It's Kafi Holi. Holi is a time of year when there's a festival of colours. It's to celebrate spring, really. And I think Panditji Ravi Shankar was incredible in that way. And he, again, was somebody who had a fantastic idea or perception of images and the connection between music and images. He, in fact, wrote the music for my favourite film of all time, Satyajit Ray's Pata Panchali. But I think with Kafi Holi, with this particular rag and this particular performance, it really has a feeling of spring, and I think it's a stunning piece.
Ravi Shankar's Kafi Holi, or the Spring Festival of Colours. And by the way, all the details of today's recordings are on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. One of the many achievements of Ravi Shankar was to actually, well, not to introduce a lot of us to this music, and of course with modern methods of beginning to send music around the world, disseminate music. I mean, I know you don't actually terribly like the term world music, do you?
No, I feel that the term world music has been used quite often to create almost a musical apartheid in music, because I think that music is music, you know, it should be equally valid, you know, wherever it comes from. And
that's true of jazz and classical, isn't it?
Exactly,
well, really?
Yeah. And I think when you apply a term that actually is based on geography rather than the style or the feeling or the flow of music, then it has a different agenda for me. And I never really kind of felt comfortable with it.
You have managed to merge very effortlessly music of East and West and various traditions. And I thought it would be nice to hear an extract from Daydream, from the album Last Days of Meaning. And you feature a very ancient Indian instrument. It's a kind of flute, isn't it?
Yeah, the bansuri. I mean, this is actually a bamboo flute and played beautifully by Ashwin Srinivasan, who I've been working with for many years now. And I remember when we recorded this, I'd written the melody and I was singing it to him and playing it to him over the internet, because he was in a studio in India, and he literally sent it over to me to put onto my backing. It was quite an involved process trying to get it to work.
Music from Daydream, composed by my guest today, Nitin Sawhney, featuring a beautiful and ancient Indian instrument, a kind of flute, played by Ashwin Srinivasan. There is a kind of, almost a sort of religious fervour involved in mastering these instruments. And your own beliefs, which I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but there's a sort of combination of Hindu philosophy and theoretical physics, which is interesting.
Yeah, I mean, that's quite an involved conversation. But I've always been very interested in both ancient Hinduism and theoretical physics. And I do find there are certain parallels, which I found gave me comfort when my father passed away. But they're also quite inspiring in lots of my work. And I was very interested in the conversations that took place between Einstein and Rabindranath Tagore, who was the Eastern polymath from India, who met him in Berlin in 1930 and 1926 as well, actually. I think it's important as a composer to have a symbiotic relationship with the world around you and to try to find inspiration from many different sources. And I think that keeps your work fresh and prevents it stagnating.
And in the same way, we need to look at music from the past in different ways and be prepared to take risks with it, as in our next piece, in fact, almost a rock and roll work, you could say.
Absolutely. I mean, I love Joan McGregor as a pianist. I've worked with her quite a lot, and with the Britain Symphonia, who she's conducting from the keyboard in this piece. Her precision with Bach is second to none, and she has incredible techniques.
And when you listen to this recording, you won't be surprised to hear that she knocks a couple of minutes off the usual timing. Thank you. That just shows, doesn't it, that Bach is such an extraordinary composer that you can do almost anything with it. And the strength of direction is such that it survives and benefits even from unusual treatment.
Oh, definitely. There's so much fire in Joanna McGregor's playing, and I think, for me, it's a very fiery piece.
Joanna McGregor playing the first movement of Bach's Keyboard Concerto No. 1 in D minor and directing from the keyboard the Britten Sinfonia, a live recording from Buenos Aires. As well as bringing Eastern and Western musical traditions together, you've also done something which Brian Eno, I know, has done, which is composed for video games. Is that interesting from the point of view of technology, from the point of view of bringing a generation of younger listeners to listen to your music?
I think a lot of composers, orchestral composers, actually have gone on to work with video games, and a lot of film composers as well. In recent years, the capacity and processing power of a lot of video games has improved dramatically. And so you can actually write a whole huge symphonic score for a video game, and it can all be contained and played back as a person's interacting with the game itself. So it gives you a lot of scope. And also, if you think about a video game compared to a film, for example, if you're scoring for a film, you have at the most, you know, a couple of hours of music. With a video game, it can be played for 50, 60 hours, and there have to be all these variations. So there are all kinds of techniques to make sure that the music never gets boring or repetitive. But it's quite challenging, because you can't just have kind of some corny music when one part of the game fails, because these are very strong narrative ideas now. For example, two of the video games I've worked with have involved the actor Andy Serkis, who was in the Lord of the Rings trilogy as playing Gollum. He was directing a lot of the drama and the action. And, you know, they start from oil paintings. They'll have 200 very, very brilliant artists sitting there and working around the clock, coming up with various oil paintings that they'll then turn into animations. So these things are stunningly beautiful these days.
You turn 50 this year, and I wonder whether, as you kind of take stock, whether you're just going to want to carry on with all of these things which are so extraordinary, or there's one specific thing you'd like to perhaps look at.
Oh, wow. I mean, there's lots of things I'd like to look at. I wrote a short film that I'm thinking of trying to direct, but ultimately I always come back to music and being a composer, because I think being a composer allows you to have a varied life. You mentioned at the beginning that I worked with Nelson Mandela, which was a strange thing, because I literally went to his house in South Africa and interviewed my absolute hero and had a chance to talk to him one-on-one for 20-odd minutes. And I couldn't have had that opportunity if not for music. So my interest in the outside world, all the things that feel important to me, are filtered through music.
Let's finish with something, Nitin Sawhney, that brings us to another extraordinary flute sound, and a musician with amazing lung power. But more importantly, because this is always what's important than pyrotechnics, is the sheer beauty of it. Tell us what it is and why you want to end on it.
Absolutely. I mean, this is from the greatest Indian classical bansuri player of all time, a Hindustani bansuri player, Hari Prasad Chaurasia. Here he's playing Rag Shudh Sarang Gat in Fast Tintal. And Gat means set composition, so it's not, there's no improvisation. This is also from an album called Daylight Rags. Again, it kind of brings home the idea that certain rags are associated with times of day and mood and colours.
And perhaps also importantly, that the music is an extension of the breath. And the breath is linked to Om, the breath of
Absolutely.
God.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the first word that was uttered in Hindu mythology, is the Om is actually literally the breath of God. And in fact, it feeds into the idea of the drone. You know, you hear the tampura, which is actually a drone, which is in a way an extension of the idea of the breath of God. But it's also elaborated on in the incredible breath of Hari Prasad Chaurasia.
On that note, I can only thank you, Nitin Sawhney, for a really fascinating programme.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. Thank you.
That was Hariprasad Chaurasia ending this edition of Private Passions. Michael Barclay's guest was the musician Nitin Sawhney. The producer was Hilary Dunn for Loftus. And you can find all the details of the recordings, along with instructions for downloading programmes in the series, on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. Next week, Michael's guest is the Holocaust survivor Eva Schloss.
The A-List on In Tune.
I am what I play, and if I don't play, I hardly exist.
I said 30 million albums, but I suspect it's more than that.
They've been talking about that for years, and I signed tons of records. People actually still buy my CDs.
When I start playing the violin, the dogs, I've got two, they've got an immediate look of, oh no, he's doing that again.
Can I start by wishing you a very happy birthday?
Thank you.
You couldn't have been more international.
Oh, I could have
success.
Done that.
How?
Oh, there were so many different things. I was too busy being sometimes a mother and always constantly hating being away from home. Even to this very day, just hate it.
Meet the A-List. In Tune. Weekdays at 4:30 with me, Sean Rafferty.
And me, Susie Klein.
Here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, this is BBC Radio 3. The time is 1 o'clock. Time now for the news, read by David Cornett.
The Foreign Secretary, William Hague, has described a row between two of his cabinet colleagues as a disciplinary matter for the government. The Education Secretary, Michael Gove, has publicly apologised about the disagreement, which centres on how to deal with allegations of extremism in schools. A special adviser to the Home Secretary, Theresa May, has resigned. Labour have called on Mrs. May to explain her part in the row. A former Egyptian army chief, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, has been sworn in as the country's new president. President Sisi swore to protect the republican system and the interests of the Egyptian people. Britain has sent a frigate, HMS Montrose, to take part in a big NATO exercise in the Baltic. The Defence Secretary, Philip Hammond, said it was right for the alliance countries to show their commitment to defend each other at a time when Russia's involvement in Ukraine was causing international concern. Some of the families of passengers on board a missing Malaysian airliner are launching a campaign to raise a £3 million reward for information leading to its whereabouts. They believe someone has vital clues about the plane's disappearance that have not yet been revealed. Pope Francis is hosting a prayer meeting at the Vatican with the Israeli president, Shimon Peres, and the Palestinian leader, Mahmoud Abbas. The cleric organising the event said it was a chance to stop and breathe rather than the beginning of any mediation between the two sides. The Wimbledon champion, Andy Murray, has appointed the former women's world number one, Amélie Mauresmo, as his head coach. The two will initially work together to prepare Murray for this summer's grass court season. Vietnamese and Philippine soldiers have socialised together on the disputed Spratly Islands in the South China Sea. The troops played football and volleyball and drank beer together. A Philippine official said the event was designed to break down any feelings of mistrust. And the weather, warm sunny spells will develop in the southeast and far southwest of England and in the far northeast of Scotland. There'll be scattered showers elsewhere. BBC News and weather at approaching 3 minutes past one.
And that was David Cornett, and I'm Jill Anderson. Good afternoon to you. At 2 o'clock, that's in an hour's time, the Early Music Show and Lucy Skeeping will be presenting a concert of German music performed by the quintessential sackbut and cornet ensemble. We'll be hearing music by Scheidt, Rosenmüller, Ahler, Schein, Krieger, Schütz and Verdank. And we'll also hear the tenor David Auchinloss. That's the Early Music Show in an hour's time. But now it's time for our lunchtime concert at Wigmore Hall in London last Monday with Sarah Walker.
Welcome to Wigmore Hall. It's always a pleasure and a privilege to hear from the A-list of Britain's musical talent. And today's lunchtime concert brings the pianist Imogen Cooper into the spotlight. She studied in France, moving there alone as a young girl of 12, went on to the Paris Conservatoire, then returned to the UK. And after that, her career has been described as having a slow burn quality, glowing brighter and brighter by the year. Definitely not a flash in the pan. And the repertoire she's lined up for us today reveals her many musical musical strengths, technical and artistic. The second half of the concert has four works by Robert and Clara Schumann, a romance and scène fantastique from Clara's Quatre Pièces Caractéristiques, and another romance by Robert along with his piano sonata number 1 in F-sharp minor, which rounds off the concert. First, though, music by a composer closely associated with the Schumanns, their good friend Johannes Brahms. We'll hear his theme and variations in D minor, which began life as the slow movement of a string sextet. When Clara Schumann heard it, she begged Brahms for a piano transcription, and he came up with this piece in time for her birthday on the 13th of September, 1860. Well, the music was never published during his lifetime, but Brahms was very fond of it, with its rather stern theme and richly contrasted variations. And Imogen Cooper is coming onto the stage now here at Wigmore Hall to play the theme and variations in D minor by Brahms.